You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, welcome back to episode 30 of the Untaming podcast. I hope you enjoyed Mary's interview last week with Meredith Small. I personally find it so fascinating learning more about our earlier human and primate ancestors. The remainder of the episodes for this season are the ones I have done myself. Back at the start of episode 26, I went on a little bit of a rant about hierarchy and the symptoms of patriarchy in our society. And there was one example that has been on my mind and I thought relevant to share at the start of this episode. And that is with regards to food. Arthur Haynes said this in the second episode of the podcast, that in Indigenous societies, the members who received the most nutrient-dense foods among the community were the children or those nourishing a child, so the pregnant or breastfeeding parents. I can't remember if he mentioned it, but this also includes parents who are preparing to conceive up to a year in advance. So the only time men are included in this is if they are going to be impregnating someone in the next year. So needless to say, it really makes me cringe when people reserve the biggest, best piece of meat for the patriarch of the family, or give all the grown men bigger or more servings of food than everyone else. Or, and this is probably more a couple of generations ago, but having the men eat first, leaving the scraps and leftovers for the women and children. This topic of why the children and those nourishing a child have higher nutritional needs could be an entire podcast episode on its own. But for now, I guess I just wanted to point out how illogical this practice is of giving more and better foods to those with lower nutritional needs. Just some food for thought. Ha! What a pun. So today's episode with Amy Haas is on the Brewer Eating Plan, a guide for how to avoid a lot of preventable pregnancy complications simply through diet. The Brewer Eating Plan and Spinning Babies Exercises. So that is episode 21 with Gail Tully are the two simplest recommendations I have for any pregnant person out there. The next episode, which I will be releasing in 2 weeks, is with Ash Perrin, the author of The Real Play Revolution and the founder of the Flying Seagull Project. They bring laughter to children in orphanages and refugee camps around the world. For now, let's hear from Amy. Six-year-old Amy Haas was born just outside of Boston in Massachusetts. She grew up in Louisiana, Long Island, Plattsburgh, all around really. She currently lives in Rochester, New York with her husband Fred and also her mother. Amy and Fred have 2 adult children, Ian and Dylan. Amy has been a childbirth educator, writer, consultant and lecturer in the field of pregnancy and birth. She has a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from Plattsburgh State University of New York and certification as a paralegal from Adelphi University in New York. Amy was trained and certified as a Bradley Method childbirth educator in 1995. Amy studied with and assisted Dr. Tom Brewer, the developer of the Brewer Pregnancy Diet, and she continues his work through pregnancy nutrition counseling. She often writes on the topic for Midwifery Today. Amy is also the education chair for Rochester Area Birth Network and the owner of Healthy Birth of Rochester. Last night she had 6 hours of sleep, definitely not as much as she would have liked, and for lunch today she had lo mein that her husband bought for her. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to meet you, Emily.
So the Brewer diet is widely recommended in natural birthing groups. So I first heard about it early in my first pregnancy, but I'm ashamed to admit that I didn't really understand it at all. And so I dismissed it and I didn't look into it again until right after the birth of my second child. Can you tell us who Dr. Brewer was and what your connection was with him?
Sure. So I became a Bradley instructor in 1995 after taking Bradley classes myself for the birth of my second child. And as I became a teacher, I had a lot of questions, because Brewer is part of the curriculum that Bradley instructors teach, the Brewer diet particularly. And so I contacted Dr. Brewer and I started asking him a lot of questions and kept calling him and kept calling him. And he didn't turn me away. And so it resulted in a relationship where I studied with him for 5 years. So I could expand on my knowledge of what I was teaching and how to explain it to other people. And so it was kind of an apprenticeship or a master's study group, so to speak. And then in the long run, I ended up helping him with his Brewer pregnancy hotline. Toward the end of his life, he had great difficulty in dealing with things like email. And he would handle the phone calls, and then he would send the people who needed answers by email to me, and I would answer them for him. It also started my writing career, so to speak, in many ways, because people misunderstood a lot of what he was trying to say. And so therefore, I tried to write articles that explained what he was trying to teach people about diet during pregnancy.
So before we delve into the Brewer diet, were these guidelines something that he came up with completely on his own, or is there a historical precedent to this knowledge?
There is a historical precedent. I remember him talking about that specifically back as far as the ancient Greeks, that diet was an important factor in pregnancy. So his history was that he worked in very poor communities, starting in the South, and he had no money to deal with. He was a community doctor, and he had little else at his disposal. In these communities, there was an incredibly high rate of preeclampsia and prematurity. So he decided to do what he called, or what is called, an interrupted timeline study, where he changed one factor of these women's lives. Since the only thing he had control over was their diets, that's what he did. Using the theories that came, again, as far back as the ancient Greeks, that diet would make a difference for these women. As a result, he analyzed what they were eating at the time, looked at what they were missing very specifically, and in most cases, it was protein. So he supplemented their diets and had them supplement their diets and had them balance their diets for more of a whole food balanced diet, and proceeded to see amazing results. So these populations had incredibly high preeclampsia rates, as high as 40%. Now, preeclampsia is a disease of pregnancy. It is a disease of symptoms, particularly high blood pressure, spots before the eyes, protein in the urine, elevated liver enzymes, upper right quadrant abdominal pain, just to name a few. And it can result in seizures that can kill both the mother and the baby. So he was trying to protect these mothers and babies. What he saw was, by simply changing their diets and having them eat a whole food, superior quality diet that is higher in protein, he eradicated preeclampsia in the populations he was working with and reduced the prematurity rate down to 2%. And if you know anything about where the prematurity rate is these days, I believe the U.S. rate is around 13%. I could be incorrect on that. I haven't checked it recently. But if you could imagine even just reducing it from 13% down to 2%, that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. So the Brewer diet, and I say Brewer diet with quotation marks because it's not this stereotypical diet that restricts food. It's more of an eating plan, right? To make sure the pregnant person is receiving enough.
Yes.
Yeah.
So very simply, it's a whole food, higher protein diet. The focus is quality over quantity.
Mm-hmm. So then I guess saying something like the Brewer eating plan may be more accurate.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So then, yeah, can you tell us what are the basic principles of the Brewer eating plan?
Well, to grow a baby and to help support a blood volume increase of 40 to 60% and stay healthy and low risk, pregnant women need to eat 2,000 to 2,600 calories a day, 75 to 100 grams of protein from varied sources, 3 to 5 servings of complex carbohydrates from whole grains. A third of the daily protein that they're getting should come from complex carbohydrates. 2 to 4 dairy products, 2 eggs a day, 3 to 5 fruits and vegetables, especially green vegetables, water to thirst, and salt to taste. And examples of some of the protein sources would include meats, fish, eggs, dairy, soy products, nuts, beans, seeds, whole grains. Basically, Dr. Brewer wanted you to think color and variety and be omnivorous if possible.
So in terms of like the protein sources, is there any difference between having a protein shake or a vegan source like lentils or something vegetarian like eggs or just something omnivorous like meat?
Well, there is a difference. Mm-hmm. With protein, what we're looking for basically is that protein is a marker for a good diet. So during pregnancy, the protein needs are increased to support both the mother and the baby. Basically, the liver synthesizes albumin, a blood protein that attracts water into circulation and helps the blood volume expand adequately. Albumin can only be made from dietary protein. So these powdered protein supplements will not do the trick. As a matter of fact, studies have shown that high protein diets without sufficient complex carbohydrates can actually cause a woman to lose weight during a time when she should be gaining in order to support her baby. A lot of the studies have been misinterpreted as indicating that too much protein is bad for women, but the major problem was that they used protein powder supplements, not dietary food sources, in other words, real food. And they left out complex carbohydrates and fruits and vegetables and dairy and nuts and beans and seeds and salt, etc. So it is not a complex diet that the pregnant body needs. Dietary protein, along with high complex carbohydrates and other nutrients, need to come from real food.
Mm-hmm. And you said before about salting to taste.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about salt because I think there's almost this widespread belief that we need to limit our salt intake. So is there a point where there's too much salt, especially in pregnancy?
Dr. Brewer felt that there wasn't. Generally, we find that, you know, telling women to salt to taste is fine. That works well. But with all of this, we're really looking at the individual woman. So some women need to cut down on their salt because they eat a ridiculous amount of salt. You have to use your common sense. Obviously, if you're eating a piece of pizza, which is pretty universally known, you don't salt it. It shouldn't be necessary. It has plenty of salt in it. If you are eating a plain food, which is where the whole food diet comes in. Say you're eating plain brown rice. Add salt. Absolutely. No problem with that. If you want to have nuts, salted nuts are just fine. But if you're eating a processed food that already has a lot of salt in it, you don't need to add salt. So you need to use your common sense with that, most definitely. I find that when I'm working with moms as a teacher, I have them do nutrition sheets, and then we look at them and determine, you know, what are you eating? Are you eating enough? Are you getting enough of this or that? So when people come to me with problems and I'll look at their nutrition sheets, I'll say, are you a person who likes salt? And one woman said to me, oh no, no one eats salt in my family. I had a family member who had a heart condition, so we never ate salt. So I said, well, you actually may need to consciously add salt to your diet. And then with other women, you actually have to tell them to double check how much salt are you getting in processed foods. Well, we don't want to be looking at you eating processed foods to begin with. A whole healthy food is not going to be a processed packaged food, if you know what I mean. So that's where I comment on using common sense to alter your salt intake. Does this make sense?
Yeah. And is there a difference in the type of salt? Like, I guess the more refined, the lower that salt is in minerals?
I would agree. I would say some good sea salt or, a Himalayan sea salt or something along those lines would be better and naturally derived. But we do have to be careful with some of our sources these days due to pollution levels. Yeah. So definitely I would just get a really good quality sea salt if you can.
Yeah. And I guess that's another mark against processed foods is that the salt in them is usually the refined salt.
That's correct.
Okay. So just going back to protein, doesn't a diet high in protein lead to high cholesterol?
Not necessarily. It depends on what you're eating. So the goal here is not to eat beef all day or drink milk all day. It's to have a varied diet. That's why we say think color and variety. So a woman who is pregnant actually needs a certain amount of cholesterol in their diet. Cholesterol is necessary for the healthy body tissues, the brain, the nervous system, liver, blood, sex, and adrenal hormones. It's also necessary for fetal and infant brain growth, which is why breast milk is so high in cholesterol. So generally saying 25 to 30% of your calories should be from healthy fats and oils. So eat oily fish, nuts, avocados, eggs, use olive oil, grapeseed oil, and small amounts of butter. But also with regard to the protein, we're including healthy fats like those from nuts. We're including beans, which are high in fiber. We're including complex carbohydrates, which are high in fiber. So we get a balance there. When I've had people who said to me, oh, well, I eat a lot of protein and I love beef and I drink a lot of milk. But when you look at their nutrition sheets, they don't eat anything else. That's not a well-balanced diet. They were missing so many elements, their fruits and their vegetables and their complex carbohydrates, for instance. So that would not be a great example of a good brewer diet in spite of the higher protein levels.
Mm. And when can you begin the brewer eating plan? Is it something to begin prior to conception in the first 12 weeks or later in pregnancy?
Absolutely. Dr. Brewer actually recommended starting it pre-pregnancy. I wouldn't think that you would need quite as much protein in the pre-pregnancy state, but really working on the quality of your diet. Most women especially don't eat higher protein diets unless they've consciously changed to that style of eating. So it does depend on the individual, which is why I analyze each individual student who comes to my classroom. So we're focusing on having those women really work on what they should be eating and what they shouldn't and ahead of time and improving the quality of their diet, so that they really get in that habit of eating a whole food diet ahead of time. And then when they are pregnant, increasing the protein levels ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And actually, I have to say, I've known some families to do cleansing diets before getting pregnant. And if that's something a woman wants to do, what I'll tell her is, okay, do it at least 3 months before you decide to get pregnant. And then when you decide to get pregnant, or even 3 months before that, start on the Brewer diet, at least increasing your protein somewhere between 40 to 75 grams of protein a day, and rebuilding your body, because the problem with these cleansing diets is they remove a lot of nutrients from the woman's body and a lot of her stores. And so they don't think about the fact that they have to build themselves back up again to have kind of a, be in a superior physical shape prior to getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm. And what if a mother, say a mother's listening right now and she's pregnant already. So would you want to start increasing? Would it make a difference between each trimester, the first, second, and third trimesters?
Yes, it absolutely would. And this is actually a point where I disagreed with Dr. Brewer. He used to say that, you know, if you didn't start out well, it wasn't just going to go well. But I and midwife Anne Fry, who is an author of midwifery textbooks, both have found that having the woman improve her nutrition at any point is helpful. The earlier, the better, of course.
Yeah.
So I was working with a mother. This is a great example. I was working with a mom who was vegan, and she was very ill during her first trimester and lost weight. Her second trimester, she comes to me for classes. She switches to an ovo-lacto-vegetarian diet, which means she added dairy products and eggs to her diet. And we got her on a Brewer version of that with higher protein levels, more balance, more nutrients, more minerals, etc. And she did very, very well until the very end of her pregnancy. And then she needed to be induced because of medical reasons. So they called me up from the hospital and said, my blood pressure is high. You know, they want me to stay and they want to induce me. And I said, well, you know, how do you feel about that? And they're like, no, we're leaving. We're leaving now. We're getting in the car as we speak. And I said, look, if she's in a dire situation, how about we compromise? Go back in, have them monitor her for the night, and then see if the situation does not improve, then you can be induced. But if it does improve, you'll get a good night's sleep and you can leave the hospital tomorrow and you don't have to worry about it. So they did this, and sure enough, the mom did not do well. She did need to be induced for medical reasons. And the midwife called me the next day. By the way, mom and baby were just fine. Everything went well. And the midwife calls me the next day and she says, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you got her on the Brewer diet when you did. A section of her placenta had atrophied, and then the other section of the placenta had grown larger than it normally would have to compensate. The midwife believed that if we hadn't gotten her onto the Brewer diet when we did, this mother would have had a stillbirth at around 7 months, whereas we were able to get her to full term. So sometimes that's our major goal, just not having a premature baby, not having a stillbirth, getting a mom to full term. It's not so much about perfect birth as it is about healthy birth.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Wow. What an example. What about earlier in the pregnancy? What if a mother is suffering from morning sickness or something more extreme like hyperemesis?
Oh, that's difficult. It's so difficult. I'm so sorry. Well, usually when I have students suffering from that, they'll contact me and I'll send them suggestions. C-bands, by the way, do help. Those are those bands that you put on your wrist and they have a little button and an acupressure point that they
can. Oh, yeah, like what you use for seasickness.
Seasickness, exactly.
Yeah.
They do help. Ginger tea helps. Mm-hmm. Smelling lemons can help. I have a whole bunch of things on my database or my computer that I might send somebody. on that. But basically, we tell women, you might have to force yourself to eat. So start with as nutritious a food as you can choose. So for instance, what's your go-to food when you don't feel well? Pasta with some salt and pepper and a little butter on it. Okay, get whole wheat pasta, get bean pasta, get something that's going to have a little bit more nutrition in it than a white pasta, and you know, definitely eat that. Try to do your best to get what you can, because some women just can't. Some women do have to go for medications for this, but there are a lot of other things that could be tried first. That is such a difficult situation now. I have had to tell women, you're going to have to force yourself to eat. Some women naturally are not eaters. They're just not interested in food, and it can be alarming. But they definitely have to do their best to get what they need. And in some cases, we get the partner involved, either a husband or a boyfriend or, you know, a family member or their life partner, whomever is their significant other, to help them with food. But as I said, that's a very, very difficult situation. Midwifery Today actually had a great article on, I think it was issue number 23, which is old, but it still stands, on natural ways of dealing with pregnancy discomforts. And one of the things that they talked about in that was nausea during pregnancy. So sometimes it's actually a problem of not having enough acid in your diet as well. So lemon water can help. As I said, ginger tea, papaya enzymes, yogurt, things that are cultured, have a good, not a lot of sugar, but do have good probiotic cultures in them. But that's a tough one. So if somebody were to call me, I would be dealing with them individually. There is no, you know, cross the board way to say how to deal with that.
Well, this next question might be kind of relevant to that, actually. So one of the biggest surprises for me upon learning about the Brewer diet was the issue of drinking water compared to nutritious fluids. And so, yeah, could you please enlighten us to nutritious fluids over plain water?
Sure. So Dr. Brewer basically said drink to thirst, but we find some women don't have a lot of thirst. So we find that they might actually have to force themselves to drink fluids. So generally what we say is 10 8-ounce glasses of fluids a day. Drink definitely water, but it might also be nutritional fluids such as V8 or bone broth or fresh squeezed juice, 3 glasses of milk. So Dr. Brewer specifically said drink a quarter of milk and eat 2 eggs a day, right? Not everybody drinks milk, so I actually will add milk substitutes to that. So for instance, I don't drink milk because I'm lactose intolerant. I drink soy milk. So I find a good high quality organic soy milk that I drink. And you have a glass of a milk or milk substitute with each meal. By the way, the only milk substitutes that come close to the nutrients found in cow's milk would be goat's milk, soy milk, or milk made from peas. And I'm trying not to say pea milk because we have a brand in the United States called Ripple, I believe, but there might be other variations of it out there. So a glass of a milk or milk substitute with each meal, 8 ounces. And then, so that's 3 right there, right? Mm-hmm. And let's say you had a V8 or some sort of vegetable juice, that's 4. And then a glass of bone broth, and then a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice. So we're up to 6. And then that leaves you a minimum of 4 glasses of water left in your fluid intake. But generally speaking, you know, that might not be enough for some women. Some women will drink all of these other fluids, those 6 other nutritive fluids, as an example. And then they may need more than 4 glasses of water a day. So that's why we say drink to thirst. I just say, just keep a thing of water with you and keep working on it throughout the day.
Yeah. And does that have to do with like, because the stomach gets smaller, you know, you don't want to put in, the, you know, the space is so precious. You don't want to put in something that doesn't contain the nutrients, right?
Right. But we are, you know, something like 98% water. So yeah. We do need water. And that's where I kind of disagree with some of these people about water. The nutritive fluids are a great idea, but you do need water as well.
Yeah. And just thinking about what you said about V8, mm-hmm. wouldn't that have like a high sort of that processed sort of saltiness in it? Or like with fruit juice, wouldn't it be high in sugar?
Well, a fresh squeezed juice would be a better choice, something you squeeze yourself. With V8, well, let's put it this way. If I can get a woman to have a glass of milk, or a V8 instead of a Coke or a Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just leave that there. And yeah, sometimes that's basically what we're trying to do, is just get women to choose more nutritional or healthier things. So I agree with you on the sugar issue with juice. I wouldn't be drinking juice throughout the day. I wouldn't be drinking fruit teas throughout the day. Having a cup of fruit tea as your as one of your many fluids during the day is fine. Having a V8, for instance, or a fruit juice that, for instance, maybe you made your own shake with kale and tomatoes and made your own kind of V8 blend, that would be perfect. I would highly recommend that. But again, we're looking for quality over quantity with this. And if I can get somebody to give up their soda, or pop, depending on what you like to call it, the sugary things with caffeine in them, and drink something that actually has some nutrition in it, that's what we're looking for. So I'm a big fan of every little bit helps.
Yeah. I think I remember reading somewhere about how you, if you're going for the fruit or the vegetable juices, to go for something that's too cloudy or dense to see through.
Yes, absolutely. And I would actually say that if you can, if you are juicing, I wouldn't juice, I would make a like a shake, so that you keep the fiber and the pectin of the fruit and the enzymes as well.
Yeah. Okay. So another big surprise to me about the Brewer diet was the avoidance of diuretic herbs, like including red raspberry leaf and nettle, which is usually recommended in pregnancy. So can you tell us more?
Well, having a cup of raspberry tea, one a day, probably not a problem. Mm-hmm. Same with nettle tea. In fact, I would combine the two. It can be nutritive for the woman. But should you drink that all day long? That's the problem. People tend to get obsessed with a food item or fluid, and they tend to overdo it. They're thinking it's a miracle, or they just overdo it. So with diuretic herbs, generally we say avoid them. That's correct. But you can add things like fresh dandelion leaves to your salad or your soup in moderation as part of your whole food complement, not as a food group or something that you are using, like somebody would take a blood pressure pill, for instance. Using it like a medication or a tincture. So it depends on what it is you're eating. So I would eat raspberries and nettles, if you can get them fresh in the spring. And I believe you're coming into your spring season there in Australia.
Yeah, New Zealand. Yep.
Yeah, New Zealand. Okay.
Yep.
And if you can find fresh nettles, and add that as a little complement, you know, like you could add your parsley to your salad. You're not going to sit down and drink a whole glass of parsley juice. That would not be good. Also probably wouldn't taste good. But throwing a little bit into a shake, or throwing it into a soup, or a stew that you're making. That is not a bad thing because these have micronutrients in them that are good for you. So moderation is the key with these things.
So what about, you mentioned it before, but what about alcohol and caffeine, since they're both diuretics and very popular drinks, so it's hard for a pregnant woman to kick? Are there any reasons to avoid them in pregnancy besides their diuretic effects?
Well, yes. Excessive caffeine has been found to contribute to miscarriage. However, a woman, pregnant woman, can have one caffeinated beverage a day. So if you want to have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea a day, one caffeinated, that's fine. The rest of the time, I would do organic, you know, if you want to have another cup, I would make it organic decaffeinated. But then you need to be drinking nutritive fluids. So I would move away from the teas at that point and head for something with some nutrition in it. Definitely. Now, alcohol, this is something I'm not going to be real popular about with the doctors. We, of course, know that six or more alcoholic beverages a day can cause fetal alcohol syndrome. Nobody should be drinking six or more alcoholic beverages a day, frankly, not pregnant or not. They can cause problems. However, I have to be honest, the research, and they don't want me to say this, frankly, shows that a woman having an occasional glass of wine or beer during her pregnancy, one sip slowly over an hour, has not been shown to exhibit problems. And the reason they don't want me to say what the research says is because the medical powers that be assume that a woman cannot control themselves and have only one, rare on occasion, you know, as a special treat. And there are a lot of countries around the world where a glass of wine is often prescribed for a pregnant woman, or a dark beer, for instance. So again, one on occasion has not been shown to be a problem, not on a daily basis, not even on a weekly basis. But that's what the research says, and I have to be honest about that. I don't lie to my students.
And how different is the Brewer diet for a mother who is breastfeeding during pregnancy or carrying twins?
Well, that places extra stress on the body. So for a mother of twins, Dr. Brewer recommended 100 to 150 grams of protein a day. And I actually have a twin mom in my class right now, and she's struggling to get everything, but she's doing a great job at increasing gradually what she needs and trying to figure out what'll work for her. And that can be varied from woman to woman. So yes, it is a lot more work. I actually had twin moms. I've had a number of them over the years, and more than half have had totally natural vaginal births, and even with a breech baby, and gone full term, which I'm very proud of. So this idea that twin moms always go premature, not necessarily. So the diet is a key point here. Definitely making sure they're getting everything that they need from this diet, and then adding extra protein for them. So one mom used to literally wake up in the middle of the night and have a snack sitting on the side of the bed. And she would have a snack in the middle of the night because she would wake up hungry. And I think that's a very wise thing to do. But make sure it's a healthy snack. So not necessarily something with sugar in it, but maybe some whole wheat crackers with peanut butter might be easy to keep on the nightstand, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the same would go also for a mother who is breastfeeding while they're pregnant. That they need to continue with the Brewer pregnancy diet and increase their nutrition. That's really hard for them though. You know, when you're taking care of another child, I give that mom a lot of credit, and do the best that you can is the best I can say, and try to get other family members and loved ones involved in feeding you and making you foods that you can easily eat and have on hand.
Yeah.
When I was interviewing midwives in my first pregnancy, I spoke to one who said he required a few things from me in order to accept me as a patient, all of which ultimately made me refuse him as a midwife in the end. But one of them was that he required me to take a glucose tolerance test because, and this is in his own words, 80% of pregnant women suffer from gestational diabetes. What do you have to say about gestational diabetes and the glucose tolerance test?
Well, Emily, have you read any of my writings on this?
Yes.
Yeah. so you kind of know what I'm going to say. Okay, so this is a complicated issue. The problem is that some women start pregnancy with poor diets, and we as human beings all have areas where of weakness. Some of us, it's blood sugar, others it's blood pressure. We're human. We have areas where we are prone to certain diseases cropping up in our bodies. Excuse me. So the problem with testing for gestational diabetes is that they had a conference, several of them actually, where they decided that they were going to look at what is called glucose intolerance of pregnancy, a woman's inability to deal with high glucose levels. And they figured nobody would pay attention to it, so they named it gestational diabetes to scare everybody. This doesn't actually mean that the woman has diabetes. So a 1-hour test is woefully inaccurate and will tell us two things. One, that woman's body does not tolerate high levels of sugar or glucose or simple carbohydrates well. It also tells us that she will be at risk for developing type 2 diabetes later in life. It may also tell us that she needs to improve her diet to start with. So what I find with the Brewer pregnancy diet is it actually can help women be rock solid on their glucose challenge test. But the 1 hour is not particularly accurate. And they recently lowered the levels so that they could, quote unquote, catch more women and diagnose them. And then my question is, what are you going to do with the information? Oh, well, we can send them for nutritional counseling. So if it's a student of mine, they're already receiving that. It's if it's a student of a Bradley instructor, generally speaking, they're already receiving information on what they should be eating. And they should be avoiding sugar and simple carbohydrates and junk food and things like that, eating that whole food varied higher protein diet, right? With lots of good complex carbohydrates. So when I talk to my students about testing for or choosing whether they're going to do a glucose tolerance test or a glucose challenge test, I usually mention the fact that there are a number of different options that they have. One, they can refuse it, but if there is a history of diabetes in their family, then they might want to be tested, because perhaps it will pick up actual diabetes in that particular woman. However, the 1 hour is not going to do that. You need to do the 3 or the 6 hour test to determine whether a woman is actually diabetic. That's number one. Number two, another way of dealing with this is a student came to me and she said, I live on a farm, we grow all our food. I always eat a whole food diet. I eat a superior diet, high quality. I never eat junk. That sugary drink that they want me to take, I can't put that in my body. I would never, ever eat anything like that. I barely eat dessert. So she decided, I didn't tell her to do this. She decided on her own that she was going to use her nutrition sheet that I give each student. And she was going to test her blood sugar before, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, before each meal, after each meal, and keep track of how it was as she normally ate on the Brewer pregnancy diet. And she took this sheet to her care provider and she said, okay, what do you think of this? And the woman said, well, this looks great, but how am I going to know if you're gestationally diabetic? And she said to her, well, what would you do if I was? And she said, well, I would have you change your diet and send you for nutritional counseling. And she started laughing. She said, well, look at this. Look at what I eat. What would you change? And she said, absolutely nothing. You're doing a great job. Never mind. Don't worry about it. So it can be an issue because a lot of women, especially in the United States, don't eat particularly wonderful diets. They eat a lot of processed foods, a lot of simple carbohydrates, a lot of junk, and they are at risk. So I recommend improving their diet using the Brewer pregnancy diet. And then if they choose to be tested, they can do the 3-hour or the 6-hour, or they can choose to do postprandial blood tests, meaning after they've eaten, to see how their blood sugar reacts. And if it's in good shape, then you don't have to worry. If they are spilling sugar in their urine, then that's a sign of a problem. And the problem I do have is a lot of obstetric practices have actually discontinued this habit of testing women, their urine for sugar, for instance. And so that kind of takes out a way of determining, ooh, if you're spilling sugar, that's a sign that you need to improve your diet, and perhaps we do need to test more.
Why have they stopped testing the urine?
Because the blood test, the glucose tolerance test, has become standard, and so their feeling was that they didn't need it. They just pick it up in the 1-hour glucose challenge.
Okay. Do they still test it for protein?
I would hope so. I would hope so, because that can be a sign of preeclampsia and or a urinary tract infection. So it depends on the individual care provider, because some of my students will say, yes, my care provider does still test my urine for both sugar and protein. And others will say, no, we're not, I'm not doing that. They don't have me do that every time I go in.
So what other, my next question was going to be about protein and testing for preeclampsia. So what other sort of early signs would there be for preeclampsia?
Well, high blood pressure is one of the first ones, swelling or edema, as it's called, protein in the urine. And so it's a kind of a combination of symptoms. Any one of them isn't necessarily preeclampsia. Elevated liver enzymes are really going to tell us a lot about how that woman is doing. Definitely keeping an eye on her and her blood pressure. That's the first hallmark, absolutely. A good, healthy woman with an expanded blood volume is going to have a fairly stable blood pressure. But you can improve the diet to correct that. So I got another story for you. I had a mom who was in great shape. She looked fabulous. And it appeared from her nutrition sheet she was eating well. She definitely was getting plenty of protein, but her blood pressure was creeping up. And her doctor said, oh, I'm going to need to induce you. And she said, came to me and she said, here's my nutrition sheet. Help, what can we do? So we looked at it and I noticed that she was eating plenty of protein, but not getting enough complex carbohydrates. So what happens when a woman eats plenty of protein, but not enough complex carbohydrates, is they burn their extra protein for energy. So I suggested that she increase her complex carbohydrates and that she also increase her green vegetables, keep the protein just where it was. And I looked at her and I said, you are a very athletic woman, aren't you? Because she was actually quite slim. And she said, oh, yes, proudly. I was a runner, but I stopped running because it was too hard on my feet. But now I walk 4 miles a day. And I said, oh, there we go. So you are an athlete. Your body is so efficient. It's burning all of your extra calories and protein for energy. So here's what I want you to do. Increase the complex carbohydrates. Keep the protein the same at 75 to 100 grams. Increase your green veggies. And I want you to cut your walking down to 2 miles a day. And 2 miles is great. That's just where everybody should be, really. And sure enough, she did these things and she went back and they checked her blood pressure and it was fine. And she told her doctor, oh, wow, you know, I changed these things in my diet and in my life. And the doctor said, ah, that's a fluke. It has nothing to do with it. So either way, she never needed to be induced. She did great. She went full term, had a healthy pregnancy, healthy baby, and a great birth experience.
Well, I've heard of things like salt shots and taking aspirin can be used to alleviate this. Is there any truth behind these?
Well, okay. So with regard to aspirin, I have to say I am not a medical care provider. I am an educator. If your doctor is prescribing something like that, that is between you and your doctor. I can't really address that. But when I last looked, there wasn't a lot of research, good research on the subject. There was some preliminary research that it showed that it helped. But as Dr. Brewer would say, if you don't improve the diet, it's not going to work. It's just going to alleviate symptoms. It's not going to alleviate the problem. If the woman isn't well nourished, and the pregnancy isn't well supported by her diet, then it isn't going to, you know, really help in the long run. That would be what he would say. So the salt shots, this is something that is, I, in the last several years, have heard about from Joy Jones, who was Dr. Brewer's nurse in his practice. It is not something I ever heard Dr. Brewer recommend or talk about. So I can't really say whether there's any research or anything behind that. But I have heard anecdotal comments from people doing this and having it help. There is a Facebook group, the Brewer Pregnancy Diet Group. And there have been anecdotal comments about this helping women who are in dire straits. I can't say that I would ever personally say to a woman, oh, go take a salt shot. I would want to look at their nutrition sheet and what they were eating and talk to them about, you know, how much salt are you getting in this and what, et cetera, before I started sending them elsewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, I think when I picture a salt shot, I'm literally picturing like a shot glass with salt in it.
I think that's what they do. But it's, again, it is not something I've ever had any of my students use. I've not seen any research on it. So I truly can't comment more than what I already have.
Yeah, thank you.
It could be great, but I don't know. Yeah. Anecdotally, other than that, I don't know.
Yeah. So I recently heard that preeclampsia is an immune response to the placenta and that someone with an autoimmune disease has a higher chance of getting it because their body is responding to the foreign invader. Do you know if there's any truth in that?
I have not read any research on that. I'm sorry. Okay. I can't actually comment on it. You know, if I had read something and read studies on it, I would tell you, but that's new to me.
So then what if somebody has an autoimmune disease? Would following the Brewer eating plan decrease their chances for developing preeclampsia?
It should for anyone. Again, it never hurts to eat a whole food, well-balanced, healthy diet with higher levels of protein for pregnant women. You know, seriously, this is a no-lose situation, improving your diet. You have nothing to lose by, you know, eating good food. Eat an orange, eat an apple, eat an egg. Eggs, by the way, are amazing. And that's something that I do recommend because Dr. Brewer said two a day. But I have a vegetarian student right now, and I said to her, you know what, go for 4 a day. Go for, you know, if that's going to be your main protein source, you can't go wrong with that, because eggs are just such an amazing source of nutrition, and they contain so many different elements that the body needs. Choline, for instance, which is one that is definitely overlooked, which is in the B vitamin family, and the DHEA, which is a hormone in the cholesterol family, and many of the B vitamins. I mean, don't throw out those yolks, seriously. No egg white omelets here. Eat the yolks. They're amazing for you.
Is there a difference in the eggs? Do you know if they're free range or just supermarket store-bought sort of?
Well, yeah. There we go back to what's available to the woman. I'm going to say, if you can get farm fresh, organic, free range eggs, get them. Make an effort to get them. However, we have in the United States, especially in cities, food deserts where women have very little access to high quality foods.
Yeah.
So do your best, you know, get the eggs you can get the milk you can get. If Kentucky Fried Chicken is the only kind of chicken that you have available to you, then eat that. That has protein. you know, I am always, always trying to make sure that women can realistically work with this diet. Do what works the best for you. Do the best you can with it. It's a fight, and it's not just for those in food deserts as well. It's for those who are on elimination diets. If you don't mind me talking about that for a little bit of a minute.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So in this day and age, we have a lot of women on what are called elimination diets. They've eliminated a food group or another from their diet.
Yeah.
And it may be that they're vegetarian. It may be that they're vegan. It may be that they're gluten-free for whatever reason, or they're dairy-free. You get the idea. Or they're soy-free. Maybe there are allergies. Who knows? For whatever reason, they have eliminated a particular food group. Those are always going to have the most challenge in getting what they need. And then women who have food aversions, or they just simply don't like food, they're going to need to work very hard to get what they need from other sources. So I just sent, for instance, the section from one of Dr. Brewer's books on vegetarian and vegan diets, which has all the substitutions for women. So if you don't eat this or that, here's what you need to eat to get the nutrients. So especially if they're vegan or vegetarian, I'm hoping that they're it's easier if they're vegetarian rather than vegan. You can do a Brewer vegan diet, but it is extraordinarily challenging. So I would ask women to stop and think, why are you eliminating these foods from your diet? Is there a true medical reason? Or is it just a belief? So I had somebody come into my class and you know, I talked about complex carbohydrates, and they're like, so they should be gluten-free. And I said, no, not necessarily. And she said, but I thought gluten-free was a good diet. I said to her, well, do you have celiac disease? And she said, no. I said, do you have an inability to process gluten? Do you have a gluten allergy? And she said, no. I said, well, then a gluten-free diet is not necessarily a healthy choice for you. Because most of the people who are following this are using a lot of processed foods. So it says it's gluten-free and we think it's healthy, but it's not. So look at the label. In the United States, all foods are required to have a label, all boxed and canned and jarred foods. There's a nutrition label on them. So look at it and see what you're getting from them. You know, how much sugar are you getting? How, you know, is it simple carbs or are they complex carbs? So if I do have somebody, for instance, who is gluten-free for a medical reason, whatever that is, or an allergy, then I will give them a list of gluten-free whole grains that they can eat. And of course, they have to be careful about the source, etc. I feel so bad for them. It's not fun. Most of the people I know who are gluten-free are doing so because they can't, you know, they have an inability to process that. But here's an interesting fact. Many of the people I've talked to who are gluten-free in the United States because they can't digest breads here, say, go to Europe and can eat the breads there.
Hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I've heard it's because the US uses a more hybridized sort of wheat,
yes,
whereas yep, it's a lot more, yeah,
right,
more of a whole grain. Yeah.
Right. I always say, you know, go for non-GMO, go for organic, go for whole grain, high fiber, etc. So, you know, I can work with anybody on any diet, but it is more challenging if you've eliminated a food group.
Yeah. So before you mentioned swelling as one of the symptoms of preeclampsia, but it's often also considered a normal symptom of pregnancy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, is it true that, and, you know, what's happening to cause that swelling and how can we help alleviate it?
Right. So originally I commented that protein was a marker for a good diet and that the liver synthesizes the blood protein albumin, which attracts water into circulation and helps the blood volume expand in a healthy way. And albumin can only be made from dietary protein. So some swelling at the end of pregnancy is normal if it is not accompanied by high blood pressure, protein in the urine, spots before the eyes, elevated liver enzymes, upper right quadrant pain, etc. Then I'm not worried about it. A woman who is preeclamptic will feel ill. She will not feel well. And she will tell you that. She just feels terrible. She just doesn't feel well at all. Whereas a woman with a healthy diet, well expanded blood volume, who's been eating well, is generally one who's going to feel fine. You know, how do you feel? I feel good. So she may need to take a look at the balance of her diet. So maybe she needs to look and see, does she need to increase her protein? Does she need to increase her minerals? Not just salt, but salt would be part of that. So magnesium and potassium and calcium, as well as sodium, just as an example, a balance of those. They definitely need to check whether they're getting enough fluids. The most natural diuretic in the world is water. So maybe that woman isn't drinking enough fluids. Maybe she's drinking nutritional fluids, but not getting enough water. So again, I'm looking at the individual mom and I'm looking at her diet and what she's doing. And that's one of the reasons Dr. Brewer used to call me up screaming, it's not just protein. You have to look at the individual woman and you have to look at the whole diet.
Yeah. So I want to see if my understanding of the Brewer eating plan is understood. So by following it correctly, the chances of developing any issues surrounding blood pressure or blood sugar levels like gestational diabetes or preeclampsia are very low, if at all. Is this right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, some women start out in very poor shape. Let's face it, 50%, at least in the United States, I don't know about New Zealand, but in the United States, 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, which means that women are potentially not necessarily in the best of shape to get pregnant when they do accidentally get pregnant. So that's something to consider. What was the woman's diet when she got pregnant beforehand? So yes, if you can start a diet like this, a whole food diet ahead of time, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What about other causes of premature birth, like placental abruption?
Again, a good healthy diet is going to help to prevent that. It can't guarantee everything. You never know what else is going on in an individual mom. Some of them start with like pre-existing hypertension, that can be a contributing cause. So women who start with what we call comorbidities, meaning other illness-related elements are going to be at higher risk. But again, it can't hurt to eat a superior diet and improve your diet overall. And definitely trying to eliminate things that could be harmful, avoiding harmful substances, chemicals, and cleaning products, and making sure any medications you're taking are actually medically necessary, because they can weaken the body in other ways and have side effects in other ways. Taking that to your doctor and talking about whether it's truly medically necessary. Not assuming that something is over the counter is safe, because it's not. Make sure it's truly medically necessary. And I give the example of, you know, if a mom has a fever, a pregnant mom has a fever of over 102, she may need to take Tylenol, or I think you call it paracetamol. maybe that's the UK, I forget, to reduce that fever, because the fever itself can be dangerous for the mother. But taking that every day for every little thing, not so much. So you have to be careful with different, Mylanta, for instance, can have elements in it that can't be absorbed by the body, and can have high levels of some heavy metals. Decongestants can shrink the placental bed. Usually I tell my moms, try using natural techniques to solve whatever problem you're trying to deal with first. Check with your care provider, of course, but if you can use a Breathe Right strip that, you know, like the football players wear over their noses, and some saline spray to clear your nose rather than using a decongestant, that would be the first thing to try, and then check with your doctor if you need to move on from there.
Now, having gone over all of this, like I said at the beginning of the episode, I didn't actually follow this diet for either of my pregnancies. Mm. And while I learned to be pretty liberal with salt, and I drank water in abundance, had a lot of red raspberry leaf tea, and I had far more starchy foods, not as much protein as I should have, yet I never experienced any swelling, blood pressure, glucose issues, and both my kids were over 8 pounds. So right. Did I just get lucky?
Well, you probably had a pretty good diet to begin with, I would guess. I can't say. I didn't look at your nutrition sheet. So I can't comment on what you did or didn't do in that. But it depends also on the age of the woman. I'm not inquiring how old you are, but if younger women are going to be more resilient, although if they're teenagers, they're still growing, then that's going to be harder on their body. They need even more nutrients and calories and et cetera. So yeah, that's a challenge as well. Not having seen your nutrition sheet, I really couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think I did eat a lot of very few processed foods and a lot of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I think I was in my mid-20s with my first pregnancy, so that all probably helped.
You're probably a healthy person to begin with for the most part. So it definitely depends. We're dealing with a lot of women these days who are not healthy and have excess weight and diets that are really, really just poor in quality. So as I said, that's why we say quality over quantity.
So, yeah, I wonder if you could give us some meal suggestions for someone on a broad diet. So maybe some different options for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks.
Well, you know, so here's what I tell my students. You want to be eating 3 meals a day. Mm-hmm. And that should include a serving size, the size of your fist. Your fist is your serving size. My fist is my serving size, if you get what I mean, of protein on your plate. Complex carbohydrate of some sort, and a fruit or a vegetable, and then a glass of milk. Eat cheap, quick, and easy, or a milk substitute like soy milk or milk made from peas. Those are the most nutritional. And then 2 snacks a day. So then usually for the snacks, it depends on what you like. It could be hummus and carrots, or an apple and peanut butter, or an apple and cheddar cheese. Some blueberries, like a half a cup of blueberries, and some nuts, an ounce of nuts. So it doesn't have to be huge amounts here. It just depends on the individual. When I talk about meal planning, a good meal can be as simple as our elementary school lunch, a whole wheat peanut butter and jelly sandwich with 2 ounces of peanut butter on it, a glass of milk, and again, as I said, 2 slices of whole wheat bread, and an apple. It can be that simple. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. But some of the great things that I tell people are, so if you're having breakfast, for instance, don't just rely on cereal and milk for your breakfast. What you want to do is you want to make sure, number one, the cereal is a whole grain, low sugar, high fiber, and preferably your milk's organic. And then add another protein to it, and then a fruit as well. So you've got 4 elements right there. When I was talking to one of my friends who is diabetic, type 1 diabetes, I said to her, Josephine, I have plain non-fat yogurt, or you could have, a pregnant woman can have regular whole yogurt. They don't have to do non-fat. But no sugar in it. And then a half a cup of fruit, usually blueberries or some type of berries, because I like berries. And then I'll take a handful of walnuts or almonds, and I'll toss those on. And then either a whole grain granola, low sugar, or a whole grain high fiber cereal that is low sugar. So I have those 4 elements, and I've got a balance there. And I notice that my blood sugar stays nice and stable. And she said, Amy, that's a perfect diabetic breakfast. Well balanced, no added sugar to it. And, you know, has 4 different elements of the complex carb, the 2 sources of protein, a calcium source, and a fruit with that. And then you could also add a glass of milk as well. But most of us for breakfast like to have coffee or tea. So that would be your 1 caffeinated beverage for the day. For other meals, something I like to recommend is take vegetables, especially something like spinach or arugula or kale, and throw them into your soups and your stews. So tonight I made a lamb ragu, and I took a whole bunch of spinach and chopped it up finely, and a whole bunch of fresh herbs, especially marjoram, because I love marjoram with lamb. And I threw it in there as I was stewing it away, and I get those nutrients in there. When I make a lasagna, I will add a green, like a spinach, a layer of baby spinach in there. When I make soups, it can be really simple to make soups, especially these days with the organic stocks that you can buy already prepared. But you can make your own bone broth, which I do recommend. From say you roasted a chicken, take all the bones, throw it in a pot with some herbs that you like. I usually like rosemary and sage with chicken. And then I cook that all day long, and then remove everything, and I have some nice stock that I can add salt to and make a soup out of, or use it in cooking, or drink it even if you like. But definitely you want to salt it. So there are a lot of different ways you can do that. I add nuts to salads and cheese to salads, beans. I tell people, play a game with yourself. See how many different food groups you can get in one bowl. So the grain bowls that have become very popular are a wonderful choice. And there are so many different things that are out there. But you do have to get creative.
You've made me so hungry now. Your dinner tonight sounds delicious. So I feel like we've covered a lot in this episode, and remembering how complicated I initially thought this eating plan was. If there's an expectant mother listening right now and you can only give her 5 brief but critical points to take away, what would they be?
Oh, only 5? So number 1, eat a whole, varied diet, whole food diet. Number two, increase the protein to a minimum of 75 grams. Three, increase your fluid intake. Definitely at least 10 glasses of 8 ounce fluids a day. Walk 1 to 2 miles a day. And take a Bradley class if that's available to you. I also had breathe and relax on my list too.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we'll add those in too. Well, I will put links in the show notes to your website, Healthy Birth of Rochester. Is there anywhere else you'd recommend if people would like to learn more or to get in contact with you?
Well, if they can get in contact with me, I can send them on. There is actually a dietitian or a nutritionist by the name of Lily Nichols, who does some wonderful podcasts. She'd be a great one to bring on your show about diet in pregnancy. And she goes a lot deeper than I do, or I am allowed to do.
Yeah.
So yes, if somebody contacts me, I am happy to help them find what they need. You'll notice in my bio, it says that I am the community resource coordinator for Rochester Area Birth Network. I am a founding member of Rochester Area Birth Network in my community. And I am still a member, but I am no longer on the board. So I have to correct that. But their website is still a great resource for all sorts of information. And that is www.rabn.org. And Midwifery Today is another good resource. The reason I write for them or have written for them in the past is because their information is so helpful.
So what was the name of the person with the podcast? Lily someone?
Lily Nichols.
Lily Nichols, okay.
Right. I can send you one of the podcasts she just did on gestational diabetes and pregnancy. And she gets really intricate with that, much more than I, as I said, I can or I am allowed to, because I am not a medical care provider.
Yeah.
Okay. So I will send you that link.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Amy, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. This is an interview I've been wanting to do for a very long time, so I really appreciate you taking the time to share this knowledge with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure as well. This has been a lot of fun.
So my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
Be kind to one another.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.